Welcome to Canadian Politique. I'm Cameron Bishop.
I'm Leanne Goodman.
And I'm Mike McDougall.
Today on the show, we're talking the van attack that took place in Toronto, the motion by the opposition Conservatives calling on the federal Liberal government to stem the influx of asylum seekers into Canada, and we're introducing a new series called Stop Me If You've Heard This One. Plus, later in the show, Dr. Hakeek Virani and I sit down with Indigenous Services Minister Dr. Jane Philpott about the work of her department, issues facing Indigenous Canadians, and why all of us need to step up and care. Gotta say, this is a big momentous day. Not only do we have one of the, if not the best minister of the Liberal government coming into the studio, but it is also our 10th episode. So well done. And who is shuffling papers today?
Not me.
Mike.
Mike. What, do you have a real job?
Mike has a real job. Yes, he does. We all do.
Yes, I do. Yes. Listen, someone's got to pay the bills because British Porn just isn't paying their way for a sponsorship.
Yeah, where's the Twinings tea sponsorship that we all wanted?
I'm working on it. Yeah. I'm working on it.
Good. That and Gazprom, right?
Yes.
Before we start, I have to say, for all the listeners out there, we have a significant number, and maybe it's because of last week's episode, Russia Gonna Rush, we have a significant number of listeners coming from the Moscow area. So if you're one of those, if you're one of those Kremlin trolls that helped deliver the Oval Office to Donald Trump, we appreciate you listening. Don't bother trying to hack us. Well, if you can hack us, get us some sponsors as well, okay?
I was going to say I can't be bought, but I clearly can. So bring it.
Vodka. Some vodka sponsors would be nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Vodka sponsors. Yeah, exactly. Leanne, you can test the vodka.
Mm-hmm. I'm a gin person, but, you know, I'll test the vodka as well.
Good. All right. Let's talk about what happened on Monday. We saw a national tragedy occur in one of the world's most multicultural cities when a van was used to attack pedestrians along Yonge Street in North Toronto. 10 people are dead, 13 are recovering from injuries described as catastrophic. The victims are predominantly female. They range in age from their mid-20s to their mid-80s. The accused, a man by the name of Alec Manassian or whatever, was taken into custody by police. Early reports coming out have identified Manassian as a member of what's called the Incel Movement, an abbreviation co-opted to describe men who feel victimized because they are, quote, involuntarily celibate. Or as Mike told me on a message the other day, in more simple, crude terms, the accused may have done this because he couldn't get laid. By way of background, the Incel acronym or abbreviation was actually originally put together or named for a group of the involuntarily celibate that was started by a young Canadian woman in 1993. And it was meant to be a type of therapeutic group for people to get together to talk about loneliness and what it meant to succeed socially in the way that they hoped. However, now it seems as though, and Monday shows us, and this is also according to University of Toronto sociology professor Judith Taylor, that the term has been co-opted by many young, mostly white men who feel victimized by their celibacy and want to come up with groups that they can blame. Moments before the van attack occurred, a post on Facebook purportedly written by the accused said, quote, "The incel rebellion has already begun. We will overthrow all of the Chads and Stacys. All hail the supreme gentleman, Elliot Rodger." And for those of you who don't know what a Chad or a Stacy is, it defines a type of individuals for which the incel men hold a deep reservoir of hatred. Chads are considered socially successful men, and the Stacys are women who are withholding their sexual opportunities from men. And the Elliot Rodger was a man who went on a killing spree early 2000, I believe.
2014,
thank you. And that is who they are holding up as their leader. What a week. Very sad.
Yeah, six people that guy killed because he couldn't get laid.
Elliot Rodger, you mean?
Yeah, Rodger.
And then this guy, 10 plus, God only hopes that nobody else dies in the hospital.
Right. Although we're not sure exactly yet whether he, you know, there's some suggestion, even though Facebook has said that the screen grab of his Facebook page was real. Apparently those 4chan idiots can have figured out a way to doctor things. And so it's not totally shut and, you know, it's not entirely certain that that's what was motivating this kid. It could have been other things, but who knows? Obviously, he's totally troubled.
What kind of a movement? I mean, there's 40,000 I read today, 40,000 identified incel followers that are on Reddit? Like, what kind of a movement is it when you can't find a relationship and you're so badly unhappy in your life that you take it out on the people around you that are successful or are completely innocent, and actually innocent and completely successful? Like, it's just, it boggles the mind that this happened in the largest city in Canada.
It's terrible. You know, as a lifelong Torontonian, it's heartbreaking. But I will say this, and I don't want to offend any of my American friends, because I have lots, including some very progressive people who haven't said this to me. But I will tell you that when this happened, when I lived in the States, when these sorts of things happen, you would hear everywhere everyone saying, "I'll bet it's a Muslim." And when this happened on Monday in Toronto, I didn't talk to a single person or hear people talking on the subway or the streetcar who didn't say, "I hope it's not a Muslim." It's a bit of a difference between the Canadian-American mindset on these sorts of things. And it made me feel sort of proud to be Canadian. Like, we don't want to demonize an ethnic minority for another one of these attacks, right? It isn't what we want to see happen. But it's heartbreaking. I mean, it's just such a terrible story. And not only on behalf of the victims, this kid's story sounds pretty terrible too. Like, he had obvious, if not mental health, he had some sort of disorder where he was a special needs kid. He had tics. He was socially awkward. He had trouble making eye contact. Like, he was obviously a troubled soul. So there's just, it's just a sad, terrible story, and I hope we get some answers. And thank God for that cop, you know?
Yeah, the cop who didn't shoot.
The cop who didn't shoot. And, you know, he's being lauded for his restraint, but the other thing that he did, by taking down a potential terrorist suspect with his nightstick, he's left us with a living, breathing suspect who may be able to shed mm-hmm. some light on the mindset and what was at play here, which so often doesn't happen. It's, they die and it's a total mystery. We've been trying to piece together pieces from their Facebook posts and from their tweets, and we don't know. And now maybe we'll find out.
Mike?
Obviously, you know, it goes without saying, this is a tragedy. And, you know, his motives, who cares what they are, but 10 people died, 16 people are in the hospital in various stages of condition, and that's awful. After the shock of what happened wore off, and I started to look for information online, because that's what we all do. We all go online, we try to find out as much as we can. And what I found very interesting was just people's reaction to the story. So, you know, Leanne is, you know, what you said, I thought was really great. And to be honest, when I first heard it, I'm like, oh, please don't be a terrorist act, right? Like, that's all we need in Toronto is to descend into the chaos that can happen when that happens. But what I also found interesting is just different people responding. And I started to find myself get angry the next day once the shock wore off. And maybe I'm being unfair, maybe I'm being a bit of an asshole right now, but I was really mad when I watched the news and I saw, I think it was CTV, and they had this reporter on the scene the next morning, and she was interviewing people, and these people coming in, and they're basically like, oh, I was there yesterday. I was in Starbucks and I ran out and I saw the van. And I'm like, man, why are you on camera right now, yeah. Dude? Like, what could it possibly serve for you to be on camera? And, you know, this one guy, like, I was driving behind beeping my horn trying to warn people. I'm like, man, why are you making this about yourself right now? I mean, there's a great, go stop what you're doing right now and Google Anthony Jeselnik thoughts and prayers. He's a comedian, and he has a bit about this where whenever a tragedy happens, people go on Facebook and they go on the news, and effectively what they're doing is they're trying to indirectly make it about them. They're saying, oh, yeah, I'm so sad. My thoughts and prayers go out to the victims. Like, the victims aren't seeing your thoughts and prayers, and they don't care about your thoughts and prayers because they're trying to recover from what happened to them. All you're doing, and I'm paraphrasing this comedian, all you're doing right there is making it about yourself and trying to make people remind people that you have feelings. And just enough. Like, why are these people on camera talking about, oh, I didn't sleep last night and I've had trouble. I don't think I'll sleep tonight. Then why don't you get off camera and go home and deal with it instead of trying to suck up to a reporter? Why are you on TV? That, I don't know. Well, that really bugged me.
It's the dreaded streeter. As a reporter, when you were asked to do a streeter, it was the thing you hated doing most, because you'd have to go to those places and those scenes, and you'd have to get people on camera to talk about how they were feeling. And it's exactly that kind of shit. And I've never understood why newsrooms want it. Like, it doesn't add anything to the story, right? But they're, you know, reporters are told to go out and talk to real people and talk about how they're feeling. And so you get a lot of that crap, and it's the horrible, horrible streeter.
It's the same thing that happens, not in any way that this is comparable, but you know, when there's some sort of a murder or heinous crime that takes place in a neighborhood, you've always got some assholes that live five or six houses down who've probably never spoken to the neighbor before in their life that committed this crime or allegedly committed the crime. And they're the first ones on the camera saying, you know, I can't believe it. You know, they were a quiet family and we never would have expected anything like that. I'm reeling from shock. If only I'd known. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of crap goes on and on. Can we also just, I know this is petty and maybe this isn't the time for it, we need to come up with something better than Toronto Strong all the time.
Oh, I know.
Boston Strong, Toronto Strong.
Thing.
Yeah, but it started, I think, with Boston during the terrorist attack that took place there.
That's the first I saw it.
Yes. So now everything, it's like the Barcelona use of the word strong. Gate in every political scandal.
Yeah.
Watergate, and now it's everything gate, and now it's everything strong. I thought that one good thing I thought was kind of clever was Young Strong as opposed to Toronto Strong. But I don't know. It's still the use of the term. But I just a tragic, tragic day. And I just hope that the individuals recover. And I also want to give a shout out to, I don't know if anybody's seen the clip of the father of the accused leaving the courthouse. And
the poor guy.
I know. And the reporters.
Did your heart not break for that man? You could see he was absolutely devastated.
Of course. And, you know, and then he's, you know, people are yelling at him, well, what do you say to the family of the victims? And he's like, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's not his fault. The man was a functioning adult. But, you know, whenever people tweet out or say thoughts and prayers, it strikes me as very often we forget that some of the very victims that we avoid praying for or giving our best thoughts to are the families for this happen. Nobody wants this.
There's a great book written by the mother of one of the Columbine kids, and it's just heartbreaking. I mean, her other kids were perfectly happy, normal, well-adjusted children, a loving family. And this kid was sort of a bad seed from the moment he emerged from the womb, and they tried everything to help him. And then that's what happens. You know, it's the worst. Imagine that's your kid.
Yeah, I know. It's absolutely brutal. I will say that one person that did weigh in on this tragedy before we switch topics was none other than displaced Canadian Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who said on Fox the other day, as we look at this attack in Toronto, we obviously don't know the details yet, but it underscores what a dangerous world we're in. This is a perilous time. Thanks, Ted. Thanks for your thoughts on that. That's very deep.
The Calgary-born Ted Cruz.
Yeah, no offense intended, Ted, but you don't know a fucking thing about the Canadian psyche, about the Canadian people. And you don't know anything about the tragedy. So how can you equate it to a dangerous time? There are sick people that lived in the 80s, in the 1800s, in the 1500s, whatever. And the only difference is now we have 24-hour run news so that people can see all the heinous activities that are going on. But then we have people like Ted Cruz who use it as some cheap way to score a political point with their sick base in the United States as a validation for continued, you know, policies that hurt immigrants, hurt the mentally disabled, that promote guns and violence and scare the piss out of people. That's what people like Ted Cruz want to do. And I have to say, one of the things that's been somewhat gratifying this week has been not seeing our politicians fall into that.
Not at all.
CNN
had a great story on, there's a great story on CNN today about the difference in the Canadian and American reaction. And, you know, I saw Fox News reporters saying that after the guy was apprehended, he looked Middle Eastern. And somebody, I forget who, but somebody put out a tweeted right back at them and said, hey, you know what? It's Toronto, and that's what we look like. He looks like he's a Torontonian.
That's right.
Right?
Well, he looks like, you know, we'll talk about this later in the show, but he looks like a Canadian. Because that's what we are.
No,
we're not some sort of a monolith. And frankly, neither are folks in the United States, although they like to think that because of that melting pot, it's turned everybody white, but it hasn't. And there is a diversity of cultures and religions. But just heart goes out to this week, and I really hope that the families can recover from what was a terrible, terrible tragedy. And I hope that this man gets justice. And I hope it doesn't come down to a mental illness where he can possibly be walking out, you know, in 5 to 10 years after doing this because he's been deemed insane. That would just be a bigger insult and tragedy, I think, too, for the families. So let's go on to the House of Commons. On Tuesday, the Liberal government and the third party NDP voted down a motion by the opposition Conservatives calling on the government to come up with a plan by May the 1st to stop the flow of asylum seekers into Canada. According to the latest data, last year the RCMP intercepted a total of 20,493 people who crossed the border into Canada illegally, and over 90% of those who crossed into Canada illegally did so through Quebec. This year, over 6,300 irregular migrants have arrived in Canada, which is more than double the 2,784 irregular migrants who arrived in Canada between January and April 2017. Last year, the majority of asylum seekers were from Haiti, while this year, the influx is predominantly from Nigeria. These individuals and their families have often been granted tourist visas in the United States, and then, according to a technical briefing by the government, they immediately come north to Canada. There's been stories about cabs that are queued up to take them to the point where they can walk over. They're charging, you know, some of these cab drivers in New York State are charging upwards of $1,500 a cab to drive people to the border. Other countries of origin this year include Colombia, the United States. Many of these may be children born in the U.S. accompanying their parents north, as well as Pakistan. Conservative MP Michelle Rempel, who we've invited on the pod to talk about the pipeline but ignores our invitations, tabled the motion and has said that while Canadians and her party support immigration, and of course we can tell that because in 2015 they were the ones promoting a ban on burqas as well as the snitch line, they support immigration, but they are concerned that a failure to address these illegal crossings into Canada will result in Canadian support for immigration declining. There is supposedly a plan going to be released shortly. But anybody have any thoughts about the ability of our government to stop, or even if we need to be stopping, illegal immigrants, as the United States would call them, or as I call them, asylum seekers who are looking for a better life? And the rate of individuals, by the way, who have committed crimes, these individuals who have come over with a history of criminality, is less than 1%.
We can demonstrate that immigrants don't commit any more crimes than anybody else. And I would pose the question of why, you know, in America, there seems to be this obsession with stopping them at the border. And my question is, why do we need to do that? Like, why not? I'm not saying just dismantle our borders, but if someone gets into the country, there's still time for us to meet with them and figure out their needs and if they should be granted, PR status in Canada or if they shouldn't. I mean, we don't have to arm the border and guard it at all times. Why can't just wait till they get to Toronto and deal with it there?
Exactly.
Also, the Atlantic Canada region is dying. Like, their population is dramatically declining. And yet there's jobs there and wages are good there. Why is this a problem? I love this bullshit explanation that it's just because, well, if they're coming in illegally, it might, you know, erode Canadian support for immigration. Where's the evidence of that? Do you hear Canadians freaking out?
No.
About these people coming over the border? Neither do I.
I hear Tory, I hear Tory fundraising letters that are freaking out because they want to scare the money out of their supporters.
It's such a U.S. style bullshit argument. And I thought they were smarter than this. I mean, Jason Kenney was fairly pro-immigration. So I don't know what is going on. And also, let's think of a way to get them to Atlantic Canada, where they desperately need workers, where the jobs are there, but the population is leaving.
It's true.
I mean, send them to Newfoundland.
Yeah, send them to Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, PEI.
Which are lovely places to live. I'm not suggesting we're sending them to Siberia. I'd kill to live in Newfoundland.
Well,
I'd love to live there.
We could always use a pod host on the rock. So, you know, just
God,
food
put
for
me
thoughts.
In Gros Morne. I'll live in Rocky Harbor. I'll be so happy. Maybe I'll find a nice Newfie man. Oh, Newfoundlander, not Newfie man. Although I have a funny story to tell you. In St. John's, they don't like if you use the word Newfie. And when I told people on the west coast of Newfoundland that they considered it a racial slur, they laughed their heads off and said, what a bunch of stupid townies. Anyway.
Well, the best city in Newfoundland is Cornerbrook. I got to say, I've never met
Cornerbrook
that I didn't like.
Is that right?
Oh, I don't know what anyway, it is. I've been there. It's a crater, basically. Corner Brook looks like a crater, and there's a highway around it, and it's just filled with amazing people. So shout out to
Newfoundland. And it's beautiful. That whole part of the province is beautiful. But, you know, it's just they're creating a problem where none exists. They're pretending that we're up in arms about this when we aren't. And when you look at the numbers, it's not that many people.
Well, and not
like, it's
only
really
that.
Not.
But she said, Michelle Rempel was quoted as saying that, now, remember, they want to tighten up border security. They want to have all sorts of, you know, militarized posts, no doubt, across the border. But generally speaking, everything that they're proposing comes with a cost, a significant cost and investment on vetting, on closing borders, what have you. And then she says, the government needs to stop throwing money at the problem and stem the flow. It's kind of like having a hole in your roof during a storm, but you're replacing the hardwoods every day.
Hmm. Yeah.
Thanks, Michelle.
That's intelligent.
Really, really deep thoughts. Like, you know, they just, I get...
deep thoughts by Michelle Rempel.
Yeah. You know, like, I was willing to have Michelle Rempel on the show. I was willing to have Michelle Rempel on the show to talk about the pipeline because obviously her and I agree on it. But, you know, it's comments like that and it's their entire approach and their false, you know, this false narrative that they're trying to present themselves as some positive alternative just because Andrew Scheer knows how to smile without shitting his pants. You know, that somehow means that they're the same angry gang of lunatics that they were for 10 years in office. And let's look at who they want to deny. Nigerians who are coming and seeking a better life because of, you know, their children are being, in many respects, taken by Boko Haram, the Islamist group. Haiti. Place is falling apart. It's an absolutely terrible, environmental, natural, political disaster zone that has continually had to rebuild. There are people coming up to escape drug cartels from Mexico, and the conservatives want to send them home? To where?
Gross. Why? Like, I'd love to have someone on this pod that can actually, and not the racist argument that like a lot of idiots will give, but there must be people out there that honestly believe that immigration is bad and they have some sort of, I mean, it's probably racist, but at least they can probably form two words. Love to have them on to explain, like, why is this a big deal? Well, why do we need to guard our borders like this?
But
like,
it'll always be a racist argument. It'll always be, but it'll be couched in economic terms.
Argument, right? It's absolutely not
an economic argument.
We did a piece of the conversation when Trump said that thing about shithole countries. We got a guy who was an expert in immigration stats to dive down into the numbers and found that actually the immigrants from the so-called shithole countries cost us next to nothing and contribute a shitload to the economy. It's the ones from the Norways, like the nuclear physicists and the high-end immigrants coming over who can't get work, they cost us more money. So it's all bullshit. And Mike, you said it perfectly in the beginning. It's not like when they cross the border, we lose them and don't know who they are, and then they start planning terrorist attacks to raid our welfare like coffers. We know where they are. We assess them then. So it's just artificial bullshit, U.S. style, don't let them come in because then, oh, God knows what will happen. It's all shit.
Yes.
And bullshit.
I would also just say that, you know, the van attack that happened, the terrorist attack that happened here, or the terrorist attack, the attack that happened on Parliament a few years ago.
The mosque attack.
Guess what? It's all homegrown Canadians.
Yeah.
You know, it's the people here that are... born, raised, and lived here their lives that have done these things. And it is the same often in France, the United States, and in countries around the world that have faced us. But the conservative answer to everything is to try and deny anybody entry that looks a little bit different, however desperate their circumstances. And that's why they're sitting on the opposition benches.
Okay, so let's let Mike do his exciting new thing.
We are introducing a new series where each of us are going to point to a story or issue this week that has grabbed our attention that others may have missed or that we want to highlight. We're going to call it for now, Stop Me If You've Heard This One. Mike, what's your story this week?
I want to talk about Rebel Media, and I want to talk about Katie Hopkins.
All right, well, let's play the clip.
I am out and about here in Toronto, and I'm finding out people's views on Justin Trudeau. Justin Trudeau, the politician, and Justin Trudeau, the celebrity. I'm also actually on the hunt for someone that looks like they actually come from Canada, because everybody here looks like they come from Africa. But you never know. I might find another Canadian before the day's out.
Wow. What the fuck? seriously, though, like, honestly, and I kind of feel like I'm a bit of a fascist when I say this, but, you know, freedom of speech, if that's freedom of speech, then we don't need it. Like, I mean, although and I say that as a podcast where we have freedom of speech, but seriously, like, how the hell is that allowed to be? Is that allowed to be called journalism? Like, I'm not a journalist, and Leanne, I'm sure you guys have, you know, ethics that you have to follow, but what the hell is wrong with Katie Hopkins, and why is she working in Canada, and why are people watching this shit?
Well, she's a racist, and Rebel Media is not a journalistic outfit, just the same way that Fox News isn't. It is a propaganda outlet designed to play to the derelicts and dregs and racists of society.
Exactly.
Who are the audience?
The words right out of my mouth.
How are they funded? Like this is just not acceptable in any form of civil discourse for her to be out there. Like, what is wrong with this person? Is this an act? I've never met Katie Hopkins. Have you met her, Leanne? Like, who is she and why?
No.
Does she really think that way? Like, how could someone really think that way? I just, it floors me. When people disagree with me, at least I can see where they're coming from. But this
I've heard of 90-year-olds thinking that way, but she doesn't seem like she's 90.
No,
you know what I mean? Like, people who came up in a different age, or, you know, even my parents were like, well, if you're going to have an interracial baby, it's really not fair to the children. Like, that whole generation, right?
Right. But this
poor
is...
poor child.
But I actually kind of like the fact that she can say this kind of stuff, Mike. I agree with you that if free speech, you know, it presents its challenges, but I'll defend the right for her to say it just so that people like us can talk about what an asshole she is and how people can see what kind of ugliness is deep within somebody's soul. And then she becomes Rebel Media. And then she becomes a subject of mockery, which would not happen if she wasn't comfortable enough in her own skin. But I would love her to go and try and say that in front of individuals, as opposed to standing safely behind her camera, go up to some of these individuals and actually tell them that they don't look like they're Canadian, but they look like they're from some Middle Eastern or African country or what have you. I'd love to see what happens then. Put her in Regent Park and have her say a few things down there. Put her at Jane and Finch. Let's see how excited she is to talk to Canadians.
No, she's in Canada. Put her at Young and Bloor.
Yeah. It's
like most Canadians would be like, shut up.
Yeah, exactly.
But not a journalist, not a news organization. It's a propaganda machine of racists.
Yep.
Short answer.
She is a
bigot. I just was floored when I saw it. I just saw that, and I wanted to go through my laptop. Like, I'm happy I wasn't on the street, because I don't know what I would have done. Like, I just can't, and it's not my job to make some old racist white lady not be old racist white lady, but... Like, give me a break. Give me a break.
Yeah, I agree.
Disgusting.
All right, Leanne, what's your story?
Okay, I would like to discuss the creepazoid attempt by Donald Trump to use his little pinky to get his wife to hold his hand.
Oh, my God. Wasn't that something? She was not having any of it.
Horrifying. Somebody put it to the Jaws music. It's really funny, but disturbing. Like, it, and if you keep looking at it, first you're transfixed by the hand action, but if you look at her face, she legitimately
cringed.
Is repulsed by that man.
Yes.
Like, legitimately. I so badly want her to be boning one of her Secret Service protection people. She's a beautiful woman.
Yes.
Yeah, she's not a lot upstairs, clearly. But she's physically a beautiful woman. The thought that she has to have sex with that man almost causes me to have a complete mental breakdown. Like, please.
That is not the first time she's had the pinky poke from the Donald, let me tell you. That was just the pinky. That was the pinky of the hand. But we know what pinky below the belt, too. Keeps firing off things left and right.
It was hilarious. So, like, I watched it over and over and over again because I couldn't look away. It's like, it was awfully awesome.
And let's just compare and contrast that to the funeral of former First Lady Barbara Bush that happened this week, where I think Melania Trump, sitting next to Obama, genuinely smiled for the first time in a year and a half, if not probably since she married Donald Trump.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Almost looked like she was happy. And Obama, you know, so charming. He was charming her like he does the rest of the world. She must think to herself, and I got to go back to that
president. President
Orange.
Pinky poke.
Horribly coiffed Disgustivo, who I married to. But, you know, she's had a, I guess she's had a pretty good life living in the Gilded Castle until now.
Yeah, the brass
anyway,
castle.
Anyway, it was awesome.
She should have read the terms of service when she bought the, you know.
Yes, you're right.
Mike, I know you got to run, so you're not going to get to hear my story. So it'll just
I'll
be Leanne and me.
I'll listen when it's posted. Take care, guys.
I'll mock him on your behalf, Mike.
Please do. Thank you.
See you later.
Okay, goodbye.
Take care. My story comes from the United States, where a candidate for the Democratic primary in the Georgia 10th Congressional District, which Trump carried handedly in 2016, has proposed a federal jobs guarantee as a key element of his platform. This idea isn't new. In fact, it was advocated for by no less than the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King. But in the age of Trump, where progressives are hungry for change and real solutions to economic and social inequality, it is becoming an issue that I think we all should be rallying for, not only in the United States, but also here in Canada. In a nutshell, here's how it would work. The federal government would provide jobs with a decent wage and benefits similar to those enjoyed by public sector workers. The candidate in the Georgia 10th, Richard Dean Winfield, is proposing a $20 per hour minimum wage. The open-ended program would be funded as needed, expandable in recession and contractible when the economy recovers. Government would effectively become the employer of last resort. And as Winfield explains, it's really the anchor of economic independence and security, which we all need to exercise other rights. The program would be a lifeline to minorities and youth who typically see far higher unemployment rates than the general population. Second, it would emphasize fulfilling community needs that the private sector has neglected. For example, these guaranteed jobs could include increasing clean energy infrastructure, broadband internet service to all, renovating and replacing affordable housing, increasing public transit in rural and urban areas, building and staffing public health, childcare, elder care, and recreational facilities, and even creating public art. So I saw that story. I reached out, and actually Richard Dean Winfield will be a guest on the pod on May the 8th. Because
wow, amazing.
I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic idea. Like, it's a thoughtful, progressive, and who could argue against it?
Well,
what would
actually,
be the
what's somebody,
the argument against it?
My mother argued against it.
Oh, your mother.
My mother said she does not like this idea because she thinks it's another tax grab. And I said, well, Mom, I'm like, how is it a tax grab when people are being paid a certain amount of money as a salary that is then going back into the economy? She couldn't really answer that, but I love you, Mom, and I'm sure that I'll hear.
Is it sort of like basic income?
Well, it's more than basic income because you're guaranteeing them a job, right? So, I mean,
right.
I suppose it's basic income in
right.
the sense that you're getting
money.
Right. You're not just getting a money, but if you want to work, I mean, we've got what, about 6% unemployment in Canada right now. Why can't, where is the progressive policy that says anybody that wants a job in Canada is going to have one, and by God, we're going to make sure that it happens. If we have infrastructure needs, which we do, we have, you know, the roads are falling apart. I don't know if you've driven down Carling Avenue anytime lately here in Ottawa. You're lucky to if your car doesn't fall in and you can't get it out. Our hospitals are falling apart. Our elder care services are garbage. I mean, why are we not investing in these big projects? That's the core to who we are as a country.
Well, there is that infrastructure bank that they're trying to get it going. But no, I think it's a great idea.
Well, he's going to be
maybe
on the pod.
Maybe Melania Trump can somehow can apply for a job and she can escape the White House.
I think the voters are going to help her escape come 2020.
Yes, that's true. Rather than having to escape her hideous husband's probing baby finger.
Baby finger and baby finger, if you know what I mean. Anyway, well, thanks for the chat this week. And Mike, wherever you are, I know you had to run to a meeting at your real
job.
Gone back
to his old job.
His real job. But the rest of us, we will stay tuned for my talk with Dr. Jane Philpott and everybody else. We will talk next week. Ciao. Well, I am hugely excited about this interview with the Honorable Dr. Jane Philpott, Minister of Indigenous Services. Hakeek and I sat down to talk to the minister about Indigenous issues in Canada, why we should all care, and what we can do about it. But just a bit of background, she is a star in many respects, not only one of the, if not the best minister in the Trudeau government, but she has been a leader in her community and in Canada for years preceding her first election to the House of Commons in the October 2015 election. She is, of course, the Member of Parliament for Markham-Stouffville, elected, as I said, in October 2015. She served as our Minister of Health federally between 2015 and 2017 and was appointed Minister of Indigenous Services in August 2017. She became a doctor more than 30 years ago to help improve people's lives and entered politics to build a healthier society. She spent the first decade of her career as a doctor in Niger, West Africa. In 1998, she and her family moved to Stouffville, Ontario, where she served for 17 years as a family physician. She was chief of family medicine at Markham-Stouffville Hospital, an associate professor in the University of Toronto's Faculty of Medicine. She led the opening of the Health for All Family Health Team and the Markham Family Medicine Teaching Unit. And in 2012, she completed a Master of Public Health degree at the University of Toronto. She's done work to promote global health, including founding Give a Day to World's AIDS in 2004 to raise money for people affected by HIV. She also helped launch Ethiopia's first training program in family medicine. She's an incredible person. She's always on her game. She is adored by her caucus colleagues, by her staff, and frankly, by a legion of people like me who really respect brilliant people and compassionate people in our public life. Here's the interview. Well, Minister Philpott, we are absolutely thrilled to have you on the pod. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I think I've harassed you enough times through direct message on Twitter, and so I just love the fact that you're sitting in this room with me. This is fantastic.
Well, it's a beautiful studio. Happy to be here.
Oh, awesome. And we've got on the line, of course, Dr. Hakeek Virani from Alberta to join us in the interview.
Hello.
Well, Minister, I want to start by saying you have had a phenomenal career. Phenomenal career. You've done so much. 30 years a physician. You've been to Niger. You've been to Ethiopia. You've did the first training guidelines for Ethiopia family medicine. Why on earth would you want to come to Ottawa and get involved in politics? Why?
Well, excellent question. I would say it actually probably arose out of my international work, because no matter where you work, if you're trying to address social inequity and health issues, you find that as a doctor, you can do a heck of a lot.
Yep.
And as a teacher of medicine, you can do even more.
Yep.
But there's a lot of the determinants of health that are in the hands of policymakers. And my increased frustration with not being able to see policies change at the global health level started to get me interested in, you know, who are these policymakers and how do I get to be one? So
yeah.
It was in conversation with, for example, the previous Prime Minister Paul Martin, who I, you know, expressed some of my frustrations around global health issues. And he said, you should run for office and fix it if you think it's not right.
But you'd never considered it before.
Not really. No,
no.
No. Maybe as a little kid, I thought it would be fun, but never seriously in my adult career until probably about 10 years or so ago.
Wow.
But, I mean, it's one thing to test the waters in, you know, as you kind of elevate your perspective from a clinician to, you know, somebody who works as a teacher and somebody who works in community health and then all the way up to big policy. But I mean, it's quite another thing. Like, you started off as a physician, your first career in medicine started in Niger. And then when you entered politics and won, your first test in politics was to be the federal minister of health, one of the largest budget departments, and also during the greatest drug safety crisis in North American history. And then you became the minister of a brand new portfolio that's responsible for providing critical services to Indigenous Canadians who experience some of the most shocking social and health inequities in the world. My question is, what is up with you and challenges? You don't do anything easy.
Well, I am really thrilled that I get an opportunity to try to address these challenges. But I think, Hakeek, you know, the skill set that you acquire in medicine is a skill set that's actually pretty transferable in the policy world as well, because you get trained to kind of look at what's wrong, you know, listen to a lot of people that sort of try to explain to you what's going wrong in their lives. You have the opportunity to use some objective tools to try to get those measurements and, you know, make an assessment as to what the roots of the problem are and then try to figure out what the treatment is. So I feel like it's just, you know, what I've gotten to do is take that skill set of analysis at the clinical level and take it to a much bigger level. And I've found that the tools are pretty transferable.
So let's just dive into a couple of questions. I know Hakeek has some and I have some. So I'm going to take it from the naive perspective of people that don't understand what you do every day. And I want to take it from maybe a little bit of a darker place. And that is, if I am an average person, let's say, and I'm one of the trolls that follow you on Twitter. Okay. Not me per se.
I don't have that many trolls, well, really.
Or, but you know, on Facebook that make, you know, crude comments or what have you about Indigenous people and their welfare and the social they miss the idea about the social determinants of health, and they talk about why can't they just assimilate? Why should I have to care about treaties that we signed 400, 500, 600 years ago? Like, why can't we just get on with it? What do you say to those people? Like, I struggle. I mean, I've got people I know that say the same thing. You know, if these individuals really want a better life, then get off reserve and get it, you know, get with the program with the rest of us. I reject that. But how do you square that circle for these people?
I think it's a fantastic question, and it really speaks to the work that I think we have to do as a Canadian society in terms of recognizing the massive gaps that exist in terms of what quality of life looks like for many Indigenous peoples in this country versus non-Indigenous peoples. And what I've been talking about lately is, you know, most Canadians have heard of Truth and Reconciliation, and we talk a lot about reconciliation. The part we don't talk as much about is truth. Mm. And I think that there's still a lot of work to do to help Canadians understand the truth. And that's our historic truths of how this country developed, particularly over the last few hundred years. When settlers, colonizers, you know, came to this land and essentially put in place policies and laws that were discriminatory against Indigenous peoples. You know, the worst of those probably is the policy around residential schools,
right,
that has had such devastating effects on people's lives. Most Canadians didn't actually learn that properly, at least Canadians of my generation and older, and maybe you're younger than me, but it sounds like, you know, I hear a lot of young people who, as they start to read and explore, say, oh my gosh, I had no idea what happened.
Yeah.
I think the vast majority of Canadians are absolutely desperately interested in learning the truth. I hear such positive feedback from Canadians who say, I'm starting to get it. Where can I learn more? And I think that's really the first step for non-Indigenous Canadians, is to understand the truth. And then, again, the vast majority of people really want to reconcile. They really recognize that we've done wrong, and that we as a whole society are not going to be healed and not going to be able to advance and enjoy you know, the fullness of Canadian life until we get it right in terms of healing that relationship with Indigenous peoples.
Do you look at New Zealand, for example? I mean, they've done a lot with the Maoris down there. I mean, it took a long time for them to get there, and the Aborigines as well in Australia. Do you look for inspiration in terms of what other countries have done to kind of guide you in your work in that regard? Or how do you bring people on board with that, with this mission? And is there inspiration that you've taken from other countries?
Well, for sure, there's always things that we can learn from other countries. And, you know, on some of our most challenging policies around, for example, our child welfare policies, we've done a lot of work in looking at other countries. I happened to be at the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues last week and met with people from other countries. But I would say the place that I find is the best place to go for inspiration is talking to First Nations, Inuit, and Métis themselves. And I've had a great privilege, especially over the last couple of years, to get to know some really remarkable people. I have to give a shout out to my colleague, the Minister of Justice, Jody Wilson-Raybould, who has taught me more than any other single person about what, not only what happened in the past and how we got into the circumstances they're in, but that the path forward is through not only acknowledging what happened in the past, but to recognize and support the implementation of the rights of Indigenous peoples. And that's a whole, you know, new conversation that many of us as Canadians haven't really had. I learn the most when I talk to First Nations, Inuit, and Métis. I hear the stories. You know, I hear Natan Obed from the Inuit Tapirik Kanatami tell about the when his family was forced to leave their community and the trauma that that has left in his life.
And we're all wearing it. We all wear it.
We're all wearing it, for sure. And the more we all get on board with saying, you know, let's actually understand that and then let's figure out what we can do to right the wrongs of the past and set a new path forward to the future, you know, all the better for all of us.
Hakeek?
Maybe we can talk a little bit about the present, because I think we can all agree that folks who have spent the time learning Canada's history or even having briefly listened to testimony from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, they don't need a lot of convincing that there are historical injustices of Indigenous people that should sadden us and for some anger and certainly motivate us to right the wrongs, as you say, of the past. But even if you just look at 2018, things aren't all better. And just last week, Colton Bushi's family addressed the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues about how systemically racist or at least broken a system must feel for them when the killing of a young First Nation man is investigated as ambivalently as it seemed to have been and prosecuted in front of a jury that included not a single Indigenous person. And of course, as you know, resulted in the acquittal of the man who pointed the gun and released the safety and pulled the trigger. And when things like this happen, and when the fastest growing prison population in the country is Indigenous women, and when families are left with no closure about missing and murdered Indigenous women, why should Indigenous people in this country feel hopeful?
Well, it's a big, difficult question. I believe that Indigenous peoples are inherently hopeful
and
inherently resilient in a way that is profound. Not everybody feels hopeful, and I always say I completely understand if you don't trust me, because we as government have not given reason to be trusted. Now, I'm not speaking of our
government, but
governments in general in Canada, because we have continually, repeatedly denied the rights of Indigenous peoples and neglected their needs. I sense, and it's hard for me to be objective in this, and both of you are probably better able to try to, you know, sense the mood of Canadians. I sense that there is a bit of a corner being turned. I give great credit to the Prime Minister, who set this as a major priority for us as a government to restore the relationship with Indigenous peoples. And I do hear positive things. You know, I met with chiefs. I meet with chiefs all the time. But, you know, a group that I met with in Manitoba a few weeks ago said, you know, we've never had a federal minister who has promised to do stuff and then has actually followed through.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, I'm not trying to, you know, claim unnecessary.
Pump your tires, right?
But
we'll just do that for you. No, but yeah.
But no, I mean, that's a sad reality if they've never been able to trust someone and no one has ever followed through with a promise. So we've got a lot of work to do to restore that trust with one another. But once we rebuild that relationship, it's amazing what we can do together. And I remember when I first said in front of a bunch of chiefs, you know, that we believe that you have the right to raise and educate your children as you see fit. And we absolutely support you drawing down jurisdiction around child welfare. And, you know, they stood up and said, we've never heard a federal government talk about drawing down jurisdiction and supporting that. So we're starting to talk about this in ways that I think they are getting, that we really do mean it about the recognition and implementation of rights. And then we're starting to also take action on really practical day-to-day things. You know, the lifting of now some, I think it's 60.
I was going to say 70, but yeah.
We're up to 60 long-term drinking water advisories that have been lifted. You know, seeing progress on Jordan's principle, where over 70,000 requests have been approved on a principle of health, supporting health of First Nations children that up until our government came into place, zero cases had been approved. So, you know, it takes that concrete action along with the spirit, I think, of respect and acknowledgement of trying to really reset the relationship.
Yeah, it really is quite telling that Jordan's principle is not a new concept, and to know that before this government there was not a single jurisdictional difficulty that was overcome in the interests of a principle so important would be discouraging for a lot of folks. And that we were in 2018 with almost 10% of the total number of water systems under the federal government's responsibility on reserve, having a shorter long-term drinking water advisory, some over a dozen years old. So Canadians have spent a lot of time in the last few months arguing about the value of oil to our country. But if you live on reserve, the most precious liquid for some people would be water. Mm. So how is it that in 2018... the people who were here first were denied water fit for human consumption? How does that happen in a developed country?
And just to preface that, I mean, Minister Philpott, you've set a goal of by the end of 2021 that all the boil water advisories will be lifted. There will be
all the long-term drinking water advisories, right? for public systems on reserve. Pardon me?
We have to say that's awesome. I mean, in terms of you know, you talk about First Nation governments, leaders, elders, community members, feeling like promises and commitments that have been made before have not been followed through on. You know, congratulations, Minister, for demonstrating already that the commitment to potable water is a real one. But maybe you can help us understand how is it that in a developed country like ours, in 2018, there are still communities who can't bathe their children in the water that's available to them.
Thank you for the question. And you're absolutely right. This is probably one of the issues that I hear the most from Canadians about, because, again, they're shocked that, you know, that people, that, you know, teenagers have grown up never being able to turn on the tap in their school or to drink the water. I think it's three things that have been lacking. One is long-term funding, adequate long-term funding. Number two, meticulous organization. And number three, political will. Mm. And those are the three things that we have had to pour into this. So we've set aside so far about $2 billion for this work, and we will make sure that this is funded adequately. But what's really important about the funding is that it's not year to year. No right. Previous government was putting anything more than 1 or 2 years of funding. Well, some of these remote communities, you require a specific design for a very unique my husband always tells me you can't modify the word unique for a unique geographic context. And you have to design specifically for that location. You have to figure out how you're going to get the building materials in, how you're going to train people that can not only construct the specific water system for that community, but also be able to operate it and maintain it over time.
Yep.
And you can't do that on 1 or 2 year funding proposals. So we have said, you know, we've got 5-year funding initially with ongoing commitments. Meticulous organization is a big part of this. So every single circumstance is different, and you have to really, you know, drill down figuratively in terms of what is the actual barrier. Sometimes it has to do with, you know, jurisdictional conversations between a municipality and a First Nation that have to kind of see eye to eye as to
right.
how they're going to share water resources, et cetera. But, you know, every long-term drinking water advisory has obstacles of those kinds of nature, in addition to the engineering obstacles. But it's the political will. It's actually a government finally saying,
you matter.
We are going to do this, and you know, nothing is going to get in the way. And I am, and our government is absolutely committed to follow through on this. I have my teams working on this every single day, and I watch it very, very closely. And you know, get on the phone to whoever I need to get on the phone to move those barriers and make sure that we get it done. And when it happens, when you see, I was in Slate Falls a couple of weeks ago, I got to go see this absolutely pristine, shiny water treatment system that had been put in place. But even better than that, I met the young man who's now a level 2 water operator, who's from that community, who's being trained, and had a smile as wide as his face in terms of the pride that he had in the system that had been designed for his yep. community, and knowing that, you know, people in his community were going to be able to count on him to make sure they could drink clean water from here on in.
So I have a question about, you referenced the remote reserves. So a few years ago, our former prime minister, who I'm a huge fan of, Mr. Chrétien, he had basically said, and I'm going to paraphrase, I've got his quote. He suggested that individuals who are on remote reserves, and he was talking about Attawaspiskat, maybe it's better to move. And what he said was, it's desirable to stay if they want to stay, but it's not always possible. So you cannot have a statement that is generic. You know, it's extremely difficult. It's one case at a time. And we know that there are issues when you're far away. It's a fly-in community. There's issues of poverty, obviously. The economic engine is often, and I have never been up to some of these reserves. It's just through reading. But, some of the economic engine is really like a corner store. That is it. That's all that's operational there. There's not a lot of opportunity. And I think about the time years ago when they evacuated Keshechewan due to drinking water advisories, and they evacuated a number of First Nations folks here down to Ottawa. I think there was about 200. This was about 10 years ago or 8 years ago. And I remember after they repopulated the reserve, that there was still a number of First Nations folks in Ottawa, now down where I lived over on Elgin Street. And the reason it stood out is because you didn't often see a lot of First Nations folks in downtown Ottawa. So I assume that after the Keshechewan incident, when a lot of them had come down, you often saw them begging, a lot of them along Elgin Street. And I remember being struck by the fact that these individuals, some of whom you'd never seen before until Keshechewan, had opted to stay and beg on the street than to go up. And I guess my question is, what do we do about some of these reserves that are, how do we empower these individuals to build a life up there? I know they're attached to the land, they're attached to all of these things, but there also is an argument that can be made that they need to be able to provide for themselves and their families and their futures in a way that is somewhat comparable to what we enjoy in major cities or rural areas. So what do we do there?
Well, that is a loaded question because you've raised a whole bunch of big issues there. Right. You've raised the issue of forced mass relocation, which we know is highly problematic.
Yep.
You've raised the issue of emergency management and the fact that, we haven't done a good job in terms of mitigating what happens when there are floods that force the evacuation of communities, for example, and getting people back home. But I'm going to jump in on the third thing that you really raised there, which is the economic issue and the fact that, people do have to leave, not always because of natural disasters like floods, but they sometimes have to leave home because of economic imperatives. Yep. This is an area where I am increasingly optimistic because I really believe that the economic empowerment piece can be addressed. It's not going to be easy, but I absolutely think that we will be able to see economic prosperity for Indigenous Canadians based, first of all, on that recognition of rights. People have a right to live where they choose. They have a right to their traditional way of life. But they also have a right to things like education. So one of the reasons that young people feel often so desperate is because they're not able to finish school. They wonder what the future is for them in terms of being able to earn a living in the place that they want to live in. So I think one of the most important investments that we have made is around education. So $2.6 billion. We're about to reach the point for the first time ever where we'll be able to say that if you're a First Nations child on reserve, you're going to have a public education funded to the same level as you would have if you were a child in a provincial school off reserve.
Fantastic.
Which is shocking, though, that we've never got there till now.
Right? That's huge.
So no wonder young people aren't graduating from high school. We haven't funded the programs adequately.
Right.
So now we're finally going to achieve equity in funding. In fact, in some cases, do even better because we're also making sure that every child is going to have funding for training in their traditional language and culture.
Yep.
We're going to have special education programming and on-the-land programming and things that are unique to the needs of those individuals or communities. As we start to get that education piece right, and I could go on all day telling you some of the really exciting things that I'm seeing happening about specific training for kids in technology jobs. And
even in these remote areas.
Even in remote areas, I think that the digital economy is going to be part of the solution. Increasingly, talking to corporate Canada about the acknowledgement of the need to address their responsibility for making sure that economic benefits accrue to the people in the neighboring communities,
right.
Which we haven't always seen in the past, unfortunately. Yeah. So I am not without hope in terms of being able to see a future again because of what I've seen, because of the ideas coming out of these communities. And, you know, someday.
And they have to be from there. It has to be from the community. It can't be, to be crude, the white man that comes in and tells them how that's failed badly. Thank you very much. Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I hear repeatedly, we have the solutions, you know, we just need your support and, you know, kind of get out of our way and let us implement the solutions
Red
that we
have. So Hakika, I know you have one question, then I have one, and then I know you have to run off to question period. So quick one, Hakika.
So Minister, last weekend in Halifax, your party had its national convention. I believe it's the last one before the 2019 general. And your party's grassroots membership, many of whom were young progressives, gave some loud and clear direction about party policy that differs from things that some of your colleagues in cabinet have said, including your successor in the Ministry of Health. And one policy that I think has a lot to do with the population that you're concerned with now has to do with the decriminalization of low-level drug possession. And we learned a week or two ago that if you're Indigenous in Canada, you're 9 times more likely to be arrested for a low-level drug possession offense, in spite of the fact that you're just as likely as any other Canadian to use those drugs. How important do you think this is, given that, you know, Indigenous people disproportionately make up the incarcerated population? How important is this policy to addressing the inequities that First Nations and Indigenous people face in this country?
Well, you won't be surprised to hear me say that I think it's a really important issue. It's a really important policy discussion. I, as you know, I'm firmly committed to a public health approach to problematic substance use. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing that you raise is just the effect that the criminal justice system has on Indigenous peoples. You know, again, Minister Wilson-Raybould has recently introduced a bill that looks at reforming our criminal justice system. I think there's much, much more work to be done to work toward an approach of restorative justice. Making sure that, you know, we look at people with health issues from a health lens. So, there's more to be done in that, regard and more conversations that have to take place. But, I think it's a good thing that these conversations are taking place.
So my last question for you is not a simple one, but I guess it's one that we see on the news, and I'm involved with a charity where we sponsor a family up in Nunavut, and then we will go up It was we will send packages 4 times a year up to the family. It can be food, it can be clothes, it can be what have you. And oftentimes we do that because it's so expensive for them to get products up there. And I think, you know, about the food in general, like we try and send, when we send stuff up, healthier things than they would find up there. How can we address the issue of the price difference? I mean, when you're paying, let's say, for a head of Maine lettuce, $15, let's just say, up in a northern community, but you can get a bag of chips for $2. How, you know, I know there's a Nutrition North program, but is there a role maybe for the IGAs, the Loblaws, the President's Choice, whatever, to come to the table and say, we're going to take ownership here and partner with the government because we recognize the government can only subsidize so much. So we're going to do what we need to do in the spirit of reconciliation to make sure that good, nutritious food is available in these communities at a cost, or in some cases free, so that these individuals don't have to reach so deep in their pocket.
Well, you raise one of the really big challenges around food security particularly in the north, but it's not just in northern communities where people are faced with challenges around food security. And certainly part of it is the role of corporate Canada to respond to. I think that there's a lot more that can be done around growing food sources more locally in many communities, and there's increasingly available technology that supports that.
Yep.
But some of it is also respecting and supporting people's ability to be able to enjoy traditional foods.
Right.
So when you look at Inuit in this country, you know, one of the effects that residential schools had on Inuit was that they were no longer able to eat the foods that they had traditionally had. And, you know, it certainly affected First Nations and Métis as well. So it's a broad-based policy challenge in terms of, you know, adjusting to that. And I think some of that work is being done. Minister Bennett, as minister responsible for Northern Affairs, is quite pressed with this issue. But there's no question, as you know, for going back to your particular question around the role of corporations, we would love to see more activity from organizations taking social responsibility for saying that it's unconscionable that we should be, you know, charging
$15 for lettuce.
Exactly.
If that's the case. But yeah. Galen Weston, you're on notice, not necessarily from Minister Philpott. So before we go, Minister, I have to ask. So you are the music director at the Community Mennonite Church in Markham-Stouffville. Is that right?
I used to lead singing. I very rarely get a chance to do that anymore.
I wasn't going to ask you to sing.
This is your chance.
This is your chance. Hakeek wanted to know if you might rap, but I don't know.
Oh, Hakeek, I would love to rap, but I would not want to do so on live podcast.
Okay, well, we'll settle for you running for prime minister.
There we go. Well, Minister, honestly, it is, you have no idea what an honor it is to have you here. You do such tremendous, tremendous work. And I'm a huge fan. Hakeek is a huge fan. There is a legion of individuals and people across the country of every race, color, creed who adore you and well-deserved.
You're extremely kind and generous.
Well, I hope you'll come back.
Okay, my pleasure. Thanks.
Bye. Well, that was pretty good. I will admit, for anybody that can't see me, and I apologize to the minister, I'm literally drenched with sweat, like drenched with sweat. I must have looked like I had dysentery or something, the amount of water that is coming out of me from my face. I don't know if that's, or maybe some sort of high grade fever, but I'm literally dripping with sweat.
Well, you've got an image fit for a podcast, Cameron.
Anything stand out from you? It was just a great interview. She's an amazing lady.
Well, here's what has always stood out for me about Minister Philpott is that she's really, really smart. And she's the first federal minister. I don't know if you know this, but she's the first federal minister of health that was a physician. And I think typically, you know, it's not the first time a doctor's been a minister in cabinet, but it's the first time that they've been tasked with the Department of Health. And she did, in the short time that she was there, did such a wonderful job, I think, and may well have saved more lives as Minister of Health than she did as a physician for 30 years with what she did around supervised injection sites.
Yeah.
And now, you know, the commitments that she and the government have made around water, I really hope that they can see these through. I hope that they can beat their target of 2021 to lift all the water advisories. And just, you know, the sensibility that she has around all of the historical and current systemic issues that are affecting the population that she's concerned with. I mean, they're all the right things to say. I just hope that she is surrounded by as many of the best and brightest minds that can help her to see these commitments through.
Yeah, she exudes compassion. She exudes brilliance, excellence. Every word I can think of, that is her. And, you know, when I hear people say, well, why don't good people get involved in politics? Well, we have a great person in Jane Philpott. And I truly believe, you know, Jane Philpott is the fixer. And
well, it's not just that she says the right things or that she's smart. You won't hear from few people. You'll hear from a lot of people that she's the hardest working person in government.
Yes.
And she's definitely the hardest working person in her department. And it's not often that you find the minister pushing as hard as she does to get things done. And, you know, part of it is that she has a government that's ostensibly committed to Indigenous health, but you know, we've been sitting with the same bureaucrats in government, regardless of government changing. We've had the same people working in the public service without as much progress as we've seen in the short time that she's been minister. I think that speaks to how hard she works.
Yeah, I agree. And that's there's a reason why she's A-list in cabinet. And I hope one day, possibly, A-listed prime minister. That's just me. But anyhow,
here.
But Jane Philpott, Minister Philpott, again, I can't thank you enough for being on the pod. And we are all better because of your service to this country.
Okay, now stop gushing.
I will stop gushing now. The only gushing that is happening is a sweat from my forehead. So we'll get that under control. And until then, thanks, everybody. Hakeek, thanks for being part of this.
Pleasure.
Okay, ciao.